This episode of UK Low Carb Podcast is sponsored by Deliciously Guilt-Free. Enjoy the show.
So it's with great, great pleasure that I now get to welcome to the screen Dr. Ted Naiman.
What I have learned over the past 2 years has been magnificent. You know, it's completely changed my life.
And so you're not going to die if you don't eat carbohydrates, but you will die if you don't eat fat and protein.
The energy I have, the life I have that has changed so amazingly in a few years, proves to me that what I'm eating is only doing me good.
I'd love to meet them because they changed my life, basically.
So I've lost now. I'm about 3 pounds off losing 5 stone.
Hello and welcome to UK Low Carb. This is your podcast, the podcast where we share the real life stories and experiences of people like you and me, people who follow the low carb or keto diet. So join me, Dan Grief, and my co-host each Friday to hear their story. And if you'd like to get involved, then please email me, dan@uklowcarb.com, or join our growing Facebook group, UK Low Carb. And finally, please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts so that we can get the message out about the amazing benefits of the low-carb and keto lifestyle. Now, this podcast is sponsored by my business, Deliciously Guilt-Free. Just use the code PODCAST and you can have 20% off your order. On with the show! Hey everyone, welcome back to another wonderful episode of UK Low Carb. And I say wonderful, not because I'm just bragging and I think that the show is wonderful, although I must admit I'm a fan of the show. Sounds a bit big-headed, but I do love listening back to these because every time I do, I'm really inspired by the people I speak to. And today is really special because I'm talking to Ted Naiman, who is my new best buddy in the States. So he's a really, really lovely guy. And I'm going to go into that in a little while. Before I do, let me just share a quick review with you that we've received recently. This one is from Ninja Julie. Ninja Julie. She says, big conversation. Now, I don't know if this was about our big conversation we had very recently with Nina Teicholz and a lovely panel of guests, was one with Tim Noakes and the Onwards in the Summer. But she says, this was an incredible podcast. The lineup was first class and so professional and encouraging to each other too. I've listened over and over again, making notes and learning so much. Thank you for this, Dan. You're really welcome, Julie. And just to let you know, as we are talking about the big conversation, Ted Naiman very, very graciously said that he would be part of the next big conversation. And so I think I have my panel complete for the next one, which I'm going to record in either late November or early December. It will be alive again. So Julie, you can watch that if you wish live, or if not, it'll come out as a podcast. And at the moment, Ted Naiman's on the panel, and I won't tell you the other two guests until they've confirmed that they're coming on. I might go for 3 guests rather than 4 next time. I think the dynamic with kind of 4, if you include me, is probably better than 5. So we'll probably have 3 guests, and then we can do more of the big conversations with fewer guests each time, but then you probably get more detail out of them too. So thanks for that, Julie. Now, I just want to say to Julie and everyone else, if you use the code FATCONVO, FATCONVO, there's actually a discount code we have on there for the month of November from my company, Deliciously Guilt Free. We make keto cakes. So if you're interested in that, go ahead. And the day this is coming out on Friday, just to let you know, our Christmas range has been launched. So if you want to go and check that out, go to deliciouslyguiltfree.com. Right. About today's show. Now, talking to Ted Naiman was a real privilege, but it came at the end of a real personal drama for me. So just to kind of go into a bit of my backstory, if you will. So the last few weeks, I've had quite a few challenges, not weeks, months, really. So firstly, my 2-year-old son has been in hospital a number of times, and he's absolutely fine, by the way. Don't worry. But it's because he was having problems breathing, so which is pretty terrifying when you're a parent and your child can't breathe properly. So he was getting grouchy and upset. And then we realized we had to take him to hospital in like September and again in October. It's been hard. And we took him in August as well. So it's been quite a few months of this now. He's then had to be nebulized and then given an inhaler. We don't know if he has asthma, but I suspect he does. So that's been challenging. And it has meant that pretty much every night for the last few months, I've not got more than a few hours sleep until I've had to wake up with him. So that's been really hard. And then my 6-year-old daughter at the weekend had her first allergic reaction. So we knew she was allergic to nuts, but she's never actually ingested any nuts until now. We only knew from the pinprick test and whatnot why she was getting these rashes and things. And it turned out she had nut allergy. But she did actually have quite a bad reaction at the weekend, last weekend. And I wasn't actually with her because she was with some of my family members. And that has just made it even worse. So it's been quite stressful. She's fine now as well, by the way. She's got an EpiPen. And now at least she's actually eaten nuts. We know for sure she definitely has an allergy. So that's been confirmed well and truly. But it has just meant that I've just been burnt out. And so, you know, lack of sleep, stress levels through the roof. Plus, you know, things like carb creep coming back in haven't helped. But this conversation with Ted has really kind of been a reboot for me. But before I tell you about him, and I do think he's a great guy, and I hope he will be a friend one day, even though I said that ironically, I just want to thank Aranda and Pete. So if you're listening, Aranda and Pete, a massive thank you to you guys, because Pete was sending me some really supportive messages throughout that time, and that really helped me get through some of those times. So Pete, thank you to you. It honestly meant a lot to me, and it really helped me. So thank you so much. And Aranda as well, whenever I post anything, you're straight away saying, are you okay? Is everyone fine in the family? And it's just so lovely to know that I've got good friends in the community who are supportive. So thank you for that. I'm also really blessed, of course, to be married to the most wonderful woman in the world, best man, my wife, who I love dearly. And, you know, going through something like this is hard. But when you've got an amazing partner like her in life, I think that made things so much better. So thank you to her too. Right, guys. So I hope you're all well, as my family is now. And hopefully now that's the drama over until Christmas and beyond, because, I've had my fill of it. Anywho, right, let's get into the amazing man who is Ted Naiman. So Ted Naiman was, first of all, suggested by one of you, the listeners, when you went onto Twitter and said, you know, why don't you go onto this show, please, Ted? And Ted said, yeah, sure. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, is this going to happen or not? And we got in touch and he very kindly came on. And he is genuinely a really nice guy. So when you meet him, there's no airs and graces. He's just himself, which I really, really appreciated that. So really, really enjoyed meeting and talking to him. In this conversation, Ted goes through with me the three macronutrients, about the roles of protein, fat and carbs in the body. We talk about a bit about human evolution. As you know, that's kind of my thing. So we kind of went into that and how, you know, we've evolved to eat a certain way. He talked about protein leverage and also the debate around higher fat and lower fat, but higher protein. So do you go high fat, low protein? Do you go higher protein, lower your fat? I think it's a really interesting debate to be had. And actually, Steve Finney had something to say about it in the summer. So we talked about what Steve Finney mentioned at the Low Carb USA conference and just, you know, what did Ted think about that? So I really love this sort of show because it shows you that, you know, we are all on a journey of discovery. I've learned so much from him, that's for sure. And I've already started implementing some of those changes in my life to give him a go. And I love the fact that we're always in this debate and discussion in this community. There's no dogma, which is exactly how it should be. You know, science is about trying to find out the truth. The truth is just there, and it's just there to be discovered. So that's why I think this is a great conversation. Anyway, guys, I hope you have a great time this week and have a great fun time this weekend. If you enjoy this show, please leave a review, because I'm actually getting to the end of my reviews now. So please leave a review if you haven't done so already and share this podcast with somebody who might benefit. Anyway, if you want to get in touch with me, my email is dan@uklowcarb.com. I love hearing from you, the listeners, and the viewers. And if you want to check out our YouTube channel, go through the list of where we all are now. This is getting a bit boring, but anyway, UK Low Carb on YouTube, and also our Facebook group, which is also UK Low Carb. Well, I think I've done enough plugging there for a lifetime. So enjoy the show and have a great weekend. Bye, guys. Hello and welcome to a very, very special live of the UK Low Carb podcast. And today I'm joined by Dr. Ted Naiman. Before I get to him, I just want to explain what this podcast is all about for those who might be new here. So this is UK Low Carb. I'm your host, Dan Grief. And this is where we share the stories of individuals like us who are living a low carb lifestyle, but more importantly, want to change their health for the better. So it's with great, great pleasure that I now get to welcome to the screen, Dr. Ted Naiman. Welcome, sir, to UK Low Carb.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Great to meet you. Great to talk to you. It's good to be here. Yeah, it's great to meet you too. And you're somebody I wanted to meet for a long, long time. And it was some people in the community who actually suggested, I think through Twitter, and you very kindly took up the invitation. So thank you so much for that. I always feel a bit bad for people I'm speaking to them in California because I'm coming to the end of my day. You're just starting your day out. So if this is grueling, if it's tiring or boring, whatever, I hope it doesn't put a dent in your day for the rest of the day. Okay, Ted?
Oh, no, it's fine. Yeah, the time zone is rough, but no, it's great here. Thank you.
Excellent stuff. So I was going to start, if I may, by just breaking down the macronutrients that we're talking about here, because you quite often hear, obviously, talk about in the keto community about fat and carbs, and people talk about protein, but not as much. And certainly when I first started looking into keto a few years ago, everybody back then was saying the same thing, which is pretty much, well, the people I was listening to, I guess, was pretty much high fat, moderate protein. So could you break down what those macronutrients are? How do they affect our bodies? And do you think that's right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so there's really just three macronutrients that we're concerned about. I mean, alcohol is maybe a fourth one, but it's basically not a food. So we're going to ignore that. There's three macronutrients we're concerned with: protein, carbohydrates, and fats. And all of these macronutrients were originally actually created by plants. Plants create all of the macronutrients. And what plants do is capture solar energy and store it as carbon chains. And so both carbohydrates and fats are actually just chains of carbons with high energy bonds. And solar energy is captured as chemical energy in these carbon chains as the high energy bonds. So plants make every bit of dietary energy for all animals in these carbon chains. They're basically hydrocarbons, which are fats, and carbohydrates, which are carbs. So in a way, both fats and carbs are very similar in that they're both just chains of carbons. And what humans do is we break apart the carbons, we break the carbons off the chains one by one, and we release little bits of energy when we break those off in our mitochondria. And that's what powers every single thing we do. Like every animal on Earth is constantly breaking apart carbon chains to stay alive. We just do that at all times at a really high rate. And that's where we get every bit of energy to just be alive. So in a way, carbs and fats are kind of the same thing because they're just both 100% pure dietary energy. They're really just carbon chains created by plants from solar energy, and we're burning them. And humans actually can burn almost exclusively carbs or almost exclusively fats. You see humans on very extreme ends of this spectrum where we can live on, you know, less than 10% fat diet or a 0% carb diet because carbs are totally not a requirement in the human diet. So you have these huge extremes. Protein is completely different. So the way plants make protein, and plants make all of our amino acids, all our proteins, they absorb minerals from the soil like nitrogen and sulfur. And the amino acids is a molecule that's centered around nitrogen. There is a little bit of carbon present and a little bit of carbon energy, but not very much. It's mostly a nitrogen-based structural molecule. And so most of our bodies is built out of protein and amino acids. Most of our function is built by proteins and amino acids. All of our enzymes and all of our hormones and all of these things are proteins. So we use proteins structurally and for function, but then all of our energy just comes from these carbon chains, which are carbs or fats. So carbs and fats are kind of both just pure energy, and you can almost switch between them, one or the other. There's some big differences between carbs and fats, though. Carbs are water soluble. Fats are not water soluble. Carbs have a lot of water associated with them. So they're very big and heavy. So whereas fats can be compressed and be very, very small. So like you can get olive oil, which is got tons of carbons in there, and it's 1/6 the weight and the volume of like a potato, which is a fully hydrated carbohydrate. We call them carbohydrates because they have all this water with them, and it weighs 6 times more and it's 6 times heavier. So because carbs are just inherently bigger and heavier and have all this water associated with them, carbohydrates, animals prefer fat. So it's lighter and it's easier to carry around. And so we store most of our energy as fat. About 99% of our energy is stored as fat. And it has to be stored in a separate compartment because it's not water soluble. And it has to be transported in our blood in a separate way because it's not water soluble. And then carbs are different. So fat stored in our fat cells, carbs are stored in our liver and our muscles as glycogen with a lot of water attached to it. It's bigger and heavier. There are other differences between carbs and fats. So carbs are burned really, really fast. If you're sprinting for your life, if you're running, if you're exercising at a super high rate, you're burning almost exclusively carbohydrate because it's so fast to burn. It's six times faster. Fat's a little bit slower, but it's more efficient. And so when you're just walking around and doing all your low intensity activities all day long, you're supposed to be burning just pure fat. There's also big differences in the storage pools in humans. We can store, you know, a nearly infinite amount of fat. Like we have so much room in our fat cells, but you're super limited on carbohydrate and glycogen. You can only store about 100 grams in your liver and maybe 300 grams in your muscles. So that's not a lot of space. So what happens is when you eat more carbohydrate than that, your whole body has to just dramatically shift over into pure carb burning mode to get rid of all those carbs because the storage is so small. So because carbohydrate storage is so small, it completely controls your whole body metabolism. If you're eating carbs, you have to burn carbs to get rid of them because you have no place to put them. And so you've got this sort of fat carb seesaw where the more carbs you eat, the less fat you burn. And you can switch back and forth between them pretty smoothly. And there are humans all over the globe eating more one or more the other. And then you've got protein in this entirely different category where you very rarely burn it for energy. It doesn't provide very much energy. If you eat just pure protein, you'll actually die of energy starvation. And protein is mostly used structurally. And so you've got a couple things going on. You've got carbs controlling the carb-fat metabolism in your body, and then you've got protein over here, which is used structurally. Well, it turns out that protein is also super important for satiety and satiety per calorie, and that's been one of my big focuses. It turns out that humans have an incredibly powerful protein satiety drive, and you're basically going to eat and eat and eat until you get enough protein, and only then will you stop eating. So my focus, you know, I came at all this from a low carb perspective, but my focus has been very heavily on protein because it turns out that if you get your carbs really low or even zero, but your protein percentage isn't high enough, you're still going to overeat non-protein energy calories, which is basically fat. So,
That is just, can I just step in there for a second? Because that is, I think, fascinating because okay, so we know that eating a lot of fat satiates you. You know, that's kind of clear to anyone who's done keto. You don't feel hungry for a long time. I've never really thought, though, what was the protein in the steak and what was the fat in the steak. I just knew that I had the steak and I didn't feel hungry for 12 hours easily. So from what I've been reading about your work and about the PE diet, that actually is the protein that we're trying to get enough of. And by getting enough of the protein, that's because we're satiated, because our bodies know there's a baseline we need to hit. And as soon as we hit that, we're not hungry. But if we filled ourselves up with fat, on the other hand, without the protein and just ate the fat, then actually we'd feel full, but we're not necessarily getting the things we need because it's only energy we're getting. It's not the building blocks to repair our bodies. Is that right?
Well, there's two totally separate concepts that I think a lot of people don't get or overlook or sail right past. There's satiety, which is not being hungry, right?
Yeah.
And then there's satiety per calorie, like how many calories did you ingest in the process of not being hungry? Fat gives you awesome satiety. If I eat a stick of butter, I'm not hungry again for the rest of my life. But that's like a trillion, billion, zillion calories. I could also eat a pound of skinless chicken breasts and I wouldn't be hungry for the rest of my life. And that's way, way, way less calories than a stick of butter. So I think people are like, oh, you know, fat gives me so much satiety. That's definitely the best macro. And that's actually maybe not true because it gives you a lot of satiety, but it also gives you a bunch of calories. I mean, so you can't really just look at how full you feel after eating a food because, I mean, the best satiety is like just eating a whole pizza, right? I mean, that's why don't I just go to the buffet and just eat like 10 plates of food? Like I have amazing satiety. I'm so not hungry after that. And I just ate like 10 trillion calories. And, you know, so if you're really looking at it from a satiety per calorie point of view, reducing carbs is evidence-based to improve satiety per calorie, especially glycemic carbs. It's a really good way to go. But increasing protein percent is also evidence-based as a good way to improve satiety per calorie. What is not evidence-based for improving satiety per calorie is eating more fat. It's actually eating less fat is better for satiety per calorie. So eating more fat is great for satiety, but it's a bunch of calories. So eating less fat is actually improving satiety per calorie, not if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, of course. And actually, the other thing I want to say there is when it's eating more protein, we're still talking about, isn't it about 18% of your intake being protein? And at the moment, it's way less than that. Like most people in the Western world eat like 12, 13, don't they? So it's a percentage. It's not saying 100% protein because you'd starve to death if you did that. You do need some energy, but it's just saying more per calorie than you're maybe necessarily getting on the Western diet. Well, for sure. Or you might be doing on the keto diet.
Absolutely. So another really important concept is this U-shaped curve, where all three of these macros are absolutely on a U-shaped curve, where you do not want to go to 0% or 100%. There is a sweet spot in the middle that's going to give you the highest satiety per calorie. So for example, protein, if you look at worldwide macronutrients in hunter-gatherers, they're at about 33% protein. Percentage of calories worldwide. Standard American diet right now is down at about 12.5% protein. And it's fallen from about 15% over the past 50 or 60 years of the obesity epidemic. And so protein is definitely on this U-shaped curve, where as you go lower and lower and lower, you start having to eat more and more calories. But then if you go too high, you basically die of energy starvation. So there's very few humans who can eat more than about 50% of their calories from protein for any length of time. They get very, very lean and very, very hungry. And so you really have to find the center of the U for protein percent. It's just that most people are too low. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But all the macros are like that. Carbohydrate is definitely like that. So humans have a specific appetite for carbohydrates. This is basically a scientific fact. And if you go all the way to zero on carbohydrate, not only are you leaving out a lot of, you know, fibrous vegetables, which have a very low energy density and crazy high satiety per calorie and a really high nutrient density, but you get to this point where if your carb intake is absolute zero, you'd have better satiety per calorie eating a little bit of carbohydrate than you would just trying to eat more fat or protein. Fat's definitely the same way. If you try to eat zero fat, you're actually going to die of a fatty acid deficiency, the omega-3, omega-6 PUFAs that are essential. But also, if you try to go below about 30% of your calories from fat, you just don't function as well. And every bodybuilder on earth will tell you this. You really just don't want to go below about 30% of your calories from fat on a maintenance level diet, because you're just going to be hungry and things aren't going to work as well. And so it's all about finding the sweet spot of the U-shaped curve for all three of the macros, where you have the highest satiety per calorie, basically where you're not hungry, but you just walk around the thinnest, because then you're going to be the most insulin sensitive and the healthiest. And I'm just saying, for most people, it's a higher protein percent than 12.5%, which is the standard American diet. And it's also way lower carbs than the 300 grams of carbs that your average American is eating per day.
It's now time for a quick keto cake break. It seems like a dream come true. Besma and I started low carb in 2015 when we were expecting our daughter. Besma had gestational diabetes and she wanted to manage her blood sugar without having to rely on medicine. We both started a low carb diet and couldn't believe how much healthier we both were. Fast forward to today, and that's exactly why we run Deliciously Guilt Free. We want to help you to enjoy a piece of cake without compromising your macros or your health. So all of our cake is around 2 grams of net carbs and less than 1 gram of naturally occurring sugar, meaning you can enjoy something sweet while on keto or a low carb diet. And the taste? I'll let our customers answer that.
It's that having a sweet treat that I can turn to with full transparency and honesty on the ingredients and the macros and everything that are included. Absolutely 100%. I love the products. I think they're really tasty. Just all around a winner.
It feels like a real treat.
They never cease to amaze me. Every single time I try them, I'm like amazed all over again.
It feels, tastes like a proper cake. I absolutely love it.
Deliciously guilt-free. Cut the carbs, not the taste. Yeah, of course, I totally agree with you on that. And this is what I think's a challenge in a way. So, okay, you and I right now, we're talking across different time zones around the globe. We can analyze our nutrition. We can write your papers on it. We can watch YouTube videos. We can learn about how to eat. But actually, you know, my bag is human evolution. And, you know, humans for millions of years have not had those advantages, or they could be seen as disadvantages. They literally had to follow their drives to try to get the nutrients that they needed. And of course, we are those same people. We still have these drives to have certain macronutrients and micronutrients as well. And those drives lead us to eating the way that we do. So just from a sort of evolutionary point of view then, what do you think would be the sweet spot kind of diet that humans have evolved to eat? Because I do mention this on the show quite often. If you look at any animal, I'm sorry for viewers and listeners who hear this all the time, but if you look at any animal on the planet, it's evolved to eat a certain way. It doesn't know why it has to eat a certain way. It just does, because by the coin sort of millions of years, it's understood by drives how to eat the best for it. So in that case, what do you think the sweet spot is for us as human beings?
Yeah, honestly, it's really easy. If I just dumped you off in the wilderness with a spear, you'd be fine. You just go ahead and kill an animal and eat the entire thing, and you're going to get at least 30% protein or maybe higher. And then if you're starving for energy, you're looking for some fruit or some tubers or some honey or something like that to add to it. And you're basically going to be just fine. You're not going to have anything in your environment that's super low in protein to the point that you have to overeat it and get fat. You're not going to find anything in your environment that's super high energy density, like a donut, where if you overeat it, you're going to get fat. Like out in nature, the highest energy density food you're really going to encounter is, you know, maybe honey at about 3.2 kilocalories per gram. That's pretty low. Like it's way lower than any kind of processed food. And you can't get fat eating this stuff no matter how hard you try. If you're eating fruits, which is like, you know, 0.9 calories per gram, you could eat, you know, 5 pounds of apples or bananas or something. You can't get fat from it. It's basically impossible. And then all of your animals are fairly lean because they're also looking for enough energy to be alive. They're not, you know, domesticated and like some super fat, you know, domesticated animal. So you're going to get an excellent protein percentage, excellent energy density if you just hunt and gather. And that's why all your hunter-gatherers are totally thin and healthy, no matter if they eat 80%, you know, carbohydrate like the Samane or the Katavans or whatever, or if they're eating, you know, no carbs like an Eskimo. I mean, they're basically going to be fine. The problem is when you process food, and not just process food, but like specifically pull the energy out in the form of a refined carbohydrate or a refined fat. So I'm mostly looking at sugar and oil, where it's just extremely refined, super high energy density, pure energy with no protein, no minerals, no satiety per calorie. You've got, you know, oil at 9 calories per gram and no protein at all. And so it's the most fatigenic thing on earth. And then carbohydrates, you know, be like pure dehydrated sugar at 4 calories per gram, which is this crazy high energy density, a huge glycemic index, gives people, you know, low blood sugar a few hours later and makes you eat more. And it's these refined energies that's really the problem. These, you know, basically stripping the carbon fat out of actual food. And so like you say, the hunter-gatherers actually don't have to worry about this. Nobody's had to worry about this for, you know, 1.5 million years. You just basically went outside and just killed something and ingested any kind of living animal, like a plant or an animal or whatever, and you're fine. And it still works today out in the wild. And that's why wild animals are always at the ideal body weight. It's only when we domesticate them and then feed them cheaper food that has refined carbs and refined fats in it that they gain weight.
So in that case then, Ted,
the protein you get from the animal. I suppose the question I'm going to ask is, if not all fats are the same, not all carbohydrates are the same, are all proteins the same? I.e. pea protein has become a massive thing in our countries the last few years. You know, I actually saw on the menu a vegan burger, which is made out of, I think it's pea protein, maybe soy protein. Is that the, does your body register it as the same protein, or do, is there a difference in the way that it uses those different types of protein?
Well, yes and no. So every protein you eat is just going to be broken down into amino acids and absorbed in your small intestine. And at that point, all the amino acids are the same. But it's the percent of amino acids that you get from plant foods versus animal foods are a little bit different. So when you eat a plant protein, you get all the proteins, all the amino acids you need in a perfect ratio to build a plant. It's not as good for building an animal. So like, it would be like if you had like a Lego kit to build a house and a Lego kit to build a car. If you're trying to build a car, you might need like 10 house Lego kits to and sort through all the pieces, not use a lot of them. And that's the way the amino acid spectrum is in plants versus animals. You've got some other issues where plant protein is also bound up in fiber and it's a little bit less digestible. So we have these protein digestibility scoring systems where animal protein is just easier to utilize. So like if you have, you know, eggs or dairy, it's really easily usable protein and you have the exact perfect amino acid spectrum to make an animal. So the animal proteins are superior. But if you have plant proteins that you combine or a fairly complete plant protein, and all the fiber stripped out. So if you had like a soy powder, it's actually not bad. You can live off of that. It's not as good, but it's definitely possible.
Right. Okay. I guess in a way, then that kind of shows that ruminants are very, very well evolved, aren't they, to their environment? You know, the way their gut is processing that matter over time, we just don't have that, do we? Unless it's being processed by a machine in a factory, we can't digest it in the same way that they can.
Right. And they're actually just cheating by using bacteria, and they're basically eating the bacteria, which are producing proteins for them. So they're, it's a hack. Yeah. So your cow is actually a microbivore and it's eating bacteria, for food. And it's basically eating the bacteria and then feeding the bacteria with the grass it eats. It's really quite wild.
Whoa, that's crazy. I've never heard somebody describe a cow as a cheater before, but I love that. I didn't know that to that level. That's absolutely fascinating. Incredible. Okay, so I want to mention two heroes of yours who I've learned about through you, and I've done a lot of reading around this. So Professors Simpson and Raubenheimer, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Professor. They did some fascinating studies, didn't they? And this is what I've kind of been learning, really, from what you've said, and then I've gone in to read about them, about locust studies and also mouse studies. And they identified that there were these kind of five drives that the locusts would go for. So, of course, we know protein, carbs, fat, but also sodium and calcium. But it seemed to be it was the protein that was by far the highest determining factor in their drive for nutrition. If they got a choice or if they're fed protein, they were healthier. A higher protein was always healthier, sorry, than lower protein, but also is what they were fed with the protein made them healthier as well. Do you want to just tell us a bit about that? Because it is really sort of fascinating research, which I imagine has kind of been the basis of a lot of your work, right?
Right. I pretty much owe all of my work to Drs. Raubenheimer and Simpson in Australia, and they have been researching protein leverage for decades. And they basically researched this protein leverage phenomenon in a lot of different species, all the way from insects up to humans. And they've basically proven that there is a protein satiety drive in most of these animals. And all of your animals will have a slightly different compromise where if they don't get enough protein, they might overeat energy to get there. That's what humans do. Or some of them are willing to just undereat protein and then not function as well to avoid getting overweight. But basically, what humans are doing, and they've proven this, is eating until they get enough protein. And that's why protein dilution is so bad for the global obesity epidemic. All of our foods are protein diluted by refined carbs and refined fats. And that's why you have to overeat carbon fast just to get enough protein. Like you can get enough protein to survive by just eating candy bars, but you have to massively overeat non-protein energy from both carbs and fats, and you're going to gain a billion pounds and be obese. And that's basically what we're dealing with. But yeah, Raubenheimer and Simpson, these guys are amazing. And I really love their work, and it's fascinating stuff.
So do you think then it's because, you know, fat, we know we store fat. I store too much fat. We know that carbs we can store as well, although you did say there's less room for glycogen. And of course, it takes up, because of the amount of water, a lot of space. Is it then because protein is something that we can't store, that it's continually being depleted unless you're eating it? So that would make sense evolutionarily why you'd then go for the protein.
Right. Yeah. So we have no real good way to store protein. And you have a huge daily requirement for absolute daily requirement for protein. If you look at the three macros, like your average human basically has to eat about 50 grams of protein a day just to stay alive. Whereas the requirement for carbohydrate daily is exactly zero. And actually, the requirement for fat is only just a gram or two. It's tiny. We only need these. We don't need any saturated fat. We don't need any monounsaturated fat. We don't need most of the polyunsaturated fats. It's just these two tiny omega-3 and omega-6 polyunsaturated fats that are essential. And you only need just a tiny gram or two of them a day. And so you've got this huge absolute requirement for protein every day of, you know, 50 grams, and then like no carb requirement and a microscopic fat requirement. The protein just becomes really, really, really important. And I think that the importance of it is unknown to most people and definitely under emphasized in the modern nutritional landscape.
Yeah, well, I was going to come on to the modern because I think, you know, I believe anyway, there's two very, probably three or four actually, very significant moments in our nutritional story. So the first one, I think, has got to be the Neolithic. So, you know, we go from that person that you described who might be surviving, eating the animal, you know, trying to forage for whatever they could to survive. And during the Neolithic, of course, we have a huge change, don't we? So, you know, suddenly we have this much more available set of calories available to us. However, it's very much based on cereal crops we're growing and other vegetables we didn't have in such abundance. And we know the impact. I mean, smaller brains, smaller stature, lower life expectancy, you know, mouth ulcers, all these all these things that are happening in that period. But what I find interesting is you go through the agricultural revolution, that, you know, these things happen again and again. But the 1960s onwards seems to be probably the most damaging we've seen in terms of human health, right? Because ultra processed foods and the emergence of these ultra processed foods, if I'm understanding you correctly, has meant that the protein has pretty much dropped to through the floor levels. The sugar has gone up massively and the bad seed oils have gone up massively, which is probably the worst combination, like the deadly trio that's happened to our health. So why did that happen? What is going on there?
Right. So if you look at the past 60 years of the global obesity and diabetes epidemics, if you graph out the macronutrients, you just see carbs and fats both going up significantly. And protein is flat as a pancake. Well, absolute protein went up a little bit just because everyone has a larger body now because we're fatter. But the percentage wise, it's gone down. So absolute protein is fairly flat. Percentage went down. And you just see carbs and fats going higher and higher and higher. And honestly, it's purely economic. We figured out how to strip all the carbs and fats out of real food. And that's what sugar and oil is. 100% pure dehydrated carb or fat with no protein, no minerals, no fiber, no satiety, the highest energy density and the lowest nutrient value. And we just dumped sugar and oil into the food supply. And that really explains the entire global obesity epidemic quite nicely. And it's mostly economic. These refined carb and fat energies have super long shelf life, really high profit margins, and you combine them together and they spike dopamine in your brain and they're addictively delicious. So, you just mix together sugar and oil and flour and make, you know, donuts or something, and people will literally overeat them hedonically because they're basically addictive. It has an almost drug-like effect on your brain. Humans are wired to seek out high energy density foods because basically you get a reward from eating high energy density food because your brain knows that's going to keep you alive during the winter time when there's no calories around. And so you get this reward from eating these high energy density carbs and fats, especially carbs and fats together. And that's why everyone's addicted to donuts and pizza and candy bars and will actually overeat them even if we're not hungry, just from a purely hedonic addictive standpoint. And that's the other part. You know, half of the obesity epidemic is dilution of protein with carbs and fats. The other half is the addictive nature of these high energy density carbs and fats together that make everybody massively overeat them. And you combine them together and you're pushing obesity forward with protein dilution. You're just trying to eat to get enough protein and not be hungry. And then you're pulling it forward with the super tasty, super high energy density carbs and fats together, like your donuts, and it's basically addictive. And the combination of the two has just been like, you just can't... No, but obesity is still just going upward and it's actually still accelerating. We haven't hit any kind of inflection point. So it's kind of terrifying.
And actually those for the individual, I mean, you know, those dual things of your body seeking protein and it's not getting enough from its food. Plus, like you said, the addictive quality being pulling you forwards to want to eat it as well and eat more of it. But for the individual, what a miserable existence that is. And we have people who are starving and putting on weight, which I know, you know, we know that, but most people in society think it's the way around. They think you're greedy and that's why you're carrying weight, but actually you're not, you're starving. You're trying to eat more and more and you're addicted to it at the same time. I mean, that is a hellish imprisonment we're putting people into right now.
It's terrible. It's actually a form of malnutrition. So obesity is malnutrition, just like, you know, like you see starving children in Africa who are super skinny. Well, obesity is the exact same way. You're really just trying to eat to satiety and get everything you need, but your food environment is so horrible that you're basically have to overeat.
Yeah, yeah. So just one thing though, that just want to step back from the protein for a second, because you just made me think then about what makes us hungry. And of course we know that low protein is one of those things, but equally the huge amounts of sugar and the insulin response, right, is a massive factor in why people are always feeling hungry. They're going through these hormonal changes throughout the day. You know, they get into the cycle, I call it, of kind of carb eating continually because they're trying to manage their hormones without realizing they're doing it because they're getting the kind of different hormonal responses. So do you think that in some way protein helps that? Because, I mean, fat clearly does. When you're eating more energy from fat, you're not having the hormonal response in the same way. Is protein also a way to try to manage that in some way, or is it not so much related?
Absolutely. So if you look at studies where they examine the glycemic load and index of a meal, and then postprandial hunger and caloric consumption. So basically, if you eat a refined carb that spikes your glucose way up, about 2, 3, 4 hours later, your hunger score is much, much higher because you're actually dipping down. And your downstream energy intake is going to be maybe even several hundred calories higher. And we've basically demonstrated that adding protein to those meals greatly reduces that effect. So you really tamp down a lot of the glycemic responses and the downstream hunger. So that's actually a really good hack. You could even take the same juice and toast meal that's going to make somebody super hungry 2, 3, 4 hours later and just throw a bunch of protein at it, and you're going to greatly blunt that response. So yeah, protein is actually sort of magical at forgiving some of these glycemic sins from carbohydrate.
Okay, excellent. So I've got a few more questions before I go to ask the people who are viewing today their questions. And I'm sure you can see there's some questions filing through, which is absolutely fantastic. But I just want to just ask some other questions about not just health today, but also want to ask about a healthy lifestyle and also about lifespan, because these are sometimes different things. And I'm sure you feel the same than me, as me, that you want to have the longest life for the healthiest life as long as possible. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was going to ask you just a few things about that, if I may. So when I was reading earlier on, which I thought was really interesting, about, you know, Robbenheimer and Simpson were talking about lower protein and lifespan being longer. They also talked about, for instance, higher protein and, like, for instance, higher what do you call it? I suppose fertility and reproduction. So I just thought, if you look at Okinawa, for instance, the example that they used, and they talk about, for instance, they have a slightly lower protein but higher carbohydrate, but they have a longer lifespan. Mm-hmm. And I thought, hang on a minute, alarm bells are going off for me, because I want to find the optimal, best diet for a human to eat. And that's suddenly jarring with me and what I thought about potentially protein should be higher. And equally, I know that, for instance, when it comes to cancers, there is, you know, there's research going on about certainly sugar with cancer, but is there, for instance, like links between protein and cancer?
So basically, first of all, the protein longevity function stuff is all on a big U-shaped curve. So yeah. You can actually live a little bit longer if you're a lower order animal with protein restriction, but your fertility goes way down. And in fact, we know, like in some of these hunter-gatherer groups that have very low protein diets, they have also lower testosterone and lower sex hormones and maybe even some lower fertility. So function and lifespan and protein is kind of on a U-shaped curve. So you could maybe function better, have higher fertility, and live less long on one extreme end, and then you'll live longer, but your reproduction and fertility and function goes way down on the other end. And there's definitely a sweet spot. Like, you really, really want to nail the sweet spot, the center of the protein U. And you want the place that gives you the really good function, really good reproduction, and also pretty good lifespan, if you know what I mean. Like, very few people would want to live an extra 5 or 10 years on the end of their life, but be like sarcopenic or osteoporotic or have reproductive issues or low sex hormones or something their whole lives as a trade-off, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So there is definitely a U-shaped curve. And I think the goal is to find the center of that. There's also another big factor, and that's that a lot of the studies showing that lower protein is better for lifespan in animals doesn't control for calories. So basically, if you're eating fewer calories and you're thinner, your lifespan tends to go up. You have less chronic disease. You're basically healthier. You're basically going to live longer. And so bumping protein percentage up might allow you to be thinner and healthier and avoid cardiometabolic disease and have a good lifespan, even if you're not necessarily eating a lot more absolute protein, if you see what I'm saying. So like, if you lower your carbs and fats and raise your protein, you might reach this sweet spot where you're maximizing lifespan and function, and your protein percent is higher, but you're actually not eating a ton more absolute protein. So okay. I think that there's some nuances there, and you're trying to raise protein percentage, but not necessarily eating a ton more absolute protein.
So can I just give you an example? I know you don't know me, so you're not going to know my particular case. But for me, I feel like I get the best results when I go a lot more carnivore with fat. And then I eat leafy greens and peppers, because a good friend of mine, Graham Phillips, who's here this evening, said about the different micronutrients as well, which is also important in those things. So I eat those things, but I avoid the starchy carbohydrates like rice and potatoes, because I just think when I have them, I get bloated, which obviously is water retention, I imagine, in the first instance, but also the huge amount of energy there is being stored as fat eventually. So in that case, it sounds like what you're saying, that it's probably in terms of priority would be protein, then fat, then maybe a bit further down the list, carbohydrate, but much, much lower in my instance. Do you think that's probably what it's like for a lot of people?
I think that's exactly what it's like for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I do think that most people are really just fighting a war of grams every day, where if they could just shave a few grams of energy off of their diet, they'd basically change their trajectory from gaining weight to losing weight. And one way to do that might be to just get a slightly higher protein percentage. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So if you can eat a steak and a salad and have a lot of satiety, but you have someone else who's eating like a slightly leaner steak or a slightly bigger salad or something, and they're getting the same amount of satiety for slightly fewer calories, that's kind of the win. That's sort of what this whole PE concept is all about. It's making tiny little progressions that will hopefully get you slightly higher satiety per calorie, but still let you enjoy your food. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, before I come on to just something that I read about this summer, I just want to talk about age and protein. So I know that breast milk is about 7%, I think, protein. Mm-hmm. So clearly babies need to have less protein. There's obviously other things that are going on in their breast milk that they do need. And I just thought it was really interesting to think about. So I've just turned 40. And so I'm very kind of aware that, you know, when I was 20, my protein needs are probably very different to now. And I thought it'd be good to try and break that down. So how does over time your protein needs change?
Right. So ironically, young, healthy people who are thin and insulin sensitive have probably the lowest protein requirement of all. So, you know, if you're a 20-year-old vegan bodybuilder who's eating a low energy density diet and doing tons of resistance exercise, you could probably have amazing body composition and function on, you know, 90 or 100 grams of protein a day. And that's actually the person who needs the protein the least. They're super active. They're burning tons of non-protein energy calories. They have no anabolic resistance because they have very high testosterone and really good hormonal profile. They have no insulin resistance because they're nice and thin, and they're not burning any protein for energy. They're not burning protein for gluconeogenesis. That person needs the least. As you get older or fatter or sicker or more diabetic, your protein needs go way up. Older people have anabolic resistance. They literally need more protein. The tragedy there is that old people are eating actually less protein. Really disturbing. Like in America, we have studies showing that American adults age 70 to 79 are eating like 68 grams of protein per day. And it's just hideous. And they're eating, you know, 250 something grams of carbohydrate. And the amount of protein they're eating is just criminally low, mostly for economic reasons. Protein is the most expensive. It's cheaper to feed them higher carb and fat foods. But so you have old people who have higher anabolic resistance, literally need more protein. Anyone who's insulin resistant actually has a higher protein requirement than someone who's thin. And it's because you burn through more protein for gluconeogenesis. People are insulin resistant are not sparing protein as well as people who are thin, and they actually destroy more of their protein for gluconeogenesis, and they actually have higher protein requirements. In fact, one of the reasons why Raubenheimer and Simpson say that obesity continues to climb, like they said, if obesity was just about protein dilution, okay, sure. You know, we used to eat 15% protein, now it's 12.5. So everyone should gain 50 pounds and just stop there. And it shouldn't go up any higher. It should just stop at the amount of protein dilution in the modern food environment. But it doesn't. It keeps climbing. And the reason for that is the fatter you get, the more insulin resistant you are, and the more your protein requirement goes up. You actually have a higher protein percentage requirement as you're fatter and more insulin resistant. And that's why obesity keeps accelerating upwards, because you got fatter from protein dilution. Now you need an even higher protein percentage, but you're eating the same protein percentage, so you get fatter yet. And then it just keeps going. There's like no stopping the acceleration, because like literally the more insulin resistant you are, the higher your protein requirement gets. And it's exactly backwards to what everyone thinks. Everyone's like, oh, a high protein diet is just for those young, active bodybuilding guys or whatever. Like the 20-year-old.
It's not a tool, is it?
It's the exact opposite.
Complete opposite. Wow.
That person could live on a much lower protein diet than someone who's sedentary, insulin resistant, sarcopenic, getting older. They need more protein, and that's just part of the tragedy here.
Something just clicked when you said that. Tim Noakes was on the show, and he said in the summer that he now, during the lockdown, he realized he was putting on some weight, although he was being very, very strict with his macros, eating a ketogenic diet. But he realized he then decided to eat more protein and up his protein and just reduce his fat a little bit. And that helped him. And I suddenly realized, yeah, of course, as you get older, as you said, that would be a natural progression that you would need to do that. So yeah, okay. So at least I'm not going to go vegan as I get older. That's the main thing. I'd be more worried if I had to do that, to be fair. Now, before I come on to those people who are watching now, just let you know, if you don't know who I'm speaking to right now, this is Ted Naiman, who's an absolute legend. And I should really put the banner at the bottom. There you go. That's him on Twitter, if you want to follow him there, at Ted Naiman. Also, we're tweeting this evening as well. I've been trying to multitask, which is quite hard for me to do. But I've been trying to do that as well and tweet. So if you want to be part of that conversation on Twitter, it's hashtag UK Low Carb. And if not, and you want to ask a question here, you can do so underneath the video in Facebook. You just have to identify yourself to StreamYard so we know who you are. Otherwise, I won't. I'll just say Facebook user. So if you could do that, it'd be great. And it's the same on YouTube. You just put a comment underneath. And I think that one does pick up your name anyway. But I'm going to come to those comments in a moment. Before I do, though, I do actually have here from this summer, I was actually watching live the discussion at the end of the Low Carb USA conference. And they always have a big panel. The people who are there and online can ask any question whatsoever. And there's a doctor there who asked about protein. And of course, instantly I thought of you because I thought this is your area. And actually, I think you were mentioned. So they thought of that too. Now, Steve Finney, he said, a bit of controversy here, he said he wants to see 1 year of data. This is a quote, but I've just cut it down a little bit. If I see 1 year of data that works on significant subject to patients, I'd be excited. So he's suggesting that there's not the evidence that higher protein, lower fat is provable, but it is the other way around. And then he goes on to say there's a Swedish study about 20, 30 years ago where they gave lean steak to the athletes, but after 2 weeks, the athletes were getting sick. And so some of them had to start dropping out. And then he also mentioned, which I know you know lots about and I do, about hunter-gatherers, when you look at the Inuit and the studies that were done there about 100 years ago, they actually noticed the Inuit were very much focusing on the fatty cuts of meat, feeding the lean meats to dogs because dogs can eat much more protein than we can. They can eat up to 50%, I believe. And so he said, well, you can see kind of anecdotally from that society that the fatty cuts were prioritized, which I don't think is mutually exclusively against eating more protein, but that was his argument. So I just wanted to put that to you and see what you thought.
Right. Well, I love Dr. Finney, right? Volek and Finney, these guys are my heroes. I think they're amazing. I love all their work. but I will say that if you look at every single study ever published in the history of medical literature anywhere on earth, all of them, 100% period, no exceptions, every single one, higher protein percent is always better than lower protein percent for anything you can measure, for body fat, for insulin resistance, for blood sugar control, for lipids, for you name it. I mean, there's basically every single study. In fact, if you look at the low carb versus low fat studies, they always have to match protein percent. Why? Because if you bump protein percent up on one, it blows everything else out of the water. Like protein percent massively overshadows carb versus fat split. I mean, this is in every study in the medical literature. I don't even understand how anyone could argue with it. In fact, we have a quite a bit of study that suggests that the real magic of carbohydrate restriction is basically you're just automatically eating more protein. And it seems that the higher protein intakes is what's powering a lot of low carb success. I think there's a little bit more to it than that, especially with really high glycemic index foods and downstream hunger. But protein percent is a really, really big deal. And it clearly and objectively trumps carb versus fatism, if you know what I'm saying.
Which has become massive the last 10 years, hasn't it?
Doctors Raubenheimer and Simpson did this amazing meta-analysis where they looked at 116 studies where humans ate ad lib amounts of food, like you just ate as much as you want, and it was all tracked, and your macronutrients were tracked. I'm sorry. And they graphed this out, right? All of these ad lib studies where they gave you a diet with certain macros, and you just ate as much as you wanted. And the amount people ate was just completely linear with protein percent, like super, super, really? Super wow. Strongly linear with protein percent, all the way from the lowest to the highest. It was just boom, straight linear protein percentage. Carbs and fats like barely even influenced it at all, like minimal effect there. Protein percent was just the entire story. And that's basically what we see throughout the medical literature. And so you know, if your goal is to try to reverse the obesity epidemic and the diabetes epidemic and basically have people not be hungry and eat fewer calories and be thinner, protein percent is far more important than carb or fat distribution. And this is basically a scientific fact. So, but I still love you, Dr. Finney. I like, you know, he is definitely one of my heroes and he's a super smart guy. And I agree with him. Like, should we have more data for a year? Yeah, absolutely. I would love to see that too. I think that would be great. I think he's right. We do need more studies. We need longer studies. We need better studies.
I'd sign up for that straight away, by the way. Mm-hmm. If you put me on a plan, Dr. Naaman, and said, follow this now for the next year, I would most certainly do that because I think it's mm-hmm. worth it for sure. I think what he said there about the fatty cuts of meat, though, I don't think is... It actually doesn't contradict what you're saying anyway, because, you know, yes, they are eating fat as their main fuel source, because as we know, there are no carbohydrates there. So even if they wanted to eat carbohydrates, it's going to be very difficult for the Inuit to be able to do that. So that's the first thing. But secondly, they're eating lots of protein with their fat. So it's not really, you know, just because they don't eat the leaner cuts doesn't mean they're not still eating a hell of a lot of protein, probably hitting their 18% easily, because that's probably what they are eating.
Right. And I totally agree with the fact that protein is on a U-shaped curve. If you go too high, really, really bad stuff happens. Almost nobody can eat higher than 50% for any length of time. If you look at all of your elite bodybuilders and your bikini models and your aesthetic athletes who are doing these show preps, they're all at, you know, 35%. We're all at, you know, 30, 35, 40%. A lot of bodybuilders who are just permanently super lean and ripped are living at this 40%. Is that optimal though for feeling good and function? No, that's probably too high. And then you go north of 50% and you're basically starving to death from an energy point of view. You get to the point where you just can't keep up from protein alone. The thermic effect of protein is so high. It's so hard to try to scavenge the energy from protein that you basically can't do it. And if you go really high on protein percent, that's what rabbit starvation is. You're literally going to die. So it's clearly on a U-shaped curve, and you'll clearly have scenarios where if you go too high, you're going to feel awful, function horribly, and then literally die. So yeah, I totally agree that, you know, you can't just say, oh, protein's good. Well, I'm just going to eat 100% protein. It's just egg whites and whey powder from now on. Because you just can't do it. You'll be horribly miserable. You'll basically die of energy starvation, and it's not good. So that's why all of these macros are just about finding the sweet spot, but pretty much everybody's too low on protein percent.
Yeah,
and too high on carbohydrate in the modern food environment.
Oh, for sure. So before I go to the questions, I just want to ask you this then. Now, we're friends now, Ted, and I'm going to ask a friend to friend, just the two of us. You're my most ripped friend, okay? So, you know, apart from exercise, which is obviously, you know, resistance training is a huge part of that, what is it you eat on average in a day?
Got it. Okay, so I'm definitely prioritizing protein. And I always just get the leanest proteins I can because I know I can add fat downstream when I'm cooking it. So if I'm buying a protein, I just get the leanest thing I can. I buy, you know, I might buy skinless poultry. I might buy chicken breast. I might buy, you know, I might buy eggs and egg whites. I might buy, instead of bacon, I might buy turkey bacon. All my proteins, I take any protein I eat and get something a little bit leaner. If I'm buying ground beef, I buy the 93% lean because I know I'm going to cook it in butter, cook it in oil, add a sauce, put some mayo on it, add some cheese, pour in some heavy cream. It's just like criminally easy to add more fat downstream, but it's really hard to take it away. So like when I buy my proteins, I'm not just getting the fattiest thing I can. I'm literally trying to get the leanest thing I can. So like instead of like full fat Greek yogurt, I'd buy, you know, like non-fat Greek yogurt. I might buy fat-free milk. I might buy I'm basically getting the leanest proteins I can. And then I do add fat in later. I'll throw in an avocado. I'll throw in some nuts. I'll throw in some, you know, higher fat dairy or some butter or oil to cook something in. And basically what's happening is that when I dilute the protein percentage with the cooking process and the stuff I add, I'm ending up as something that's still pretty high. Instead of just getting like the fattiest ribeye I possibly can from a cow that's grain fed, artificially fattened, way fatter than it should be. And then I eat the fattiest part of that. You know what I'm saying? I'm starting off kind of negative and it goes downhill from there once I cook it in butter and add a sauce and then eat some carbs on the side or whatever. So like my secret is basically choosing slightly leaner proteins. And that's what the PEA approach is all about. You take whatever it is you're eating now and you just bump up the protein to energy ratio slightly. So like you're eating eggs and bacon, maybe you eat eggs and turkey bacon, or maybe you eat two eggs and two egg whites and bacon, or maybe if you're elite, you eat two eggs, two egg whites and turkey bacon and you're really high protein energy ratio. And basically you're trying to get the highest satiety for the fewest calories. And it always looks like getting a leaner protein and shaving off some grams of carbs and grams of fat. If I eat something with carb, like, so like a typical day for me is just a bunch of lean protein. I'm eating like lean beef. I'm eating eggs and egg whites. I'm eating fish. I'm eating seafood. I'm eating poultry. I'm trying to get the leanest thing I reasonably can. And then for carbs, I try to get the lowest energy density carbs that I can, right? So like 100 grams of sugar is 100 grams of carbs, but 100 grams of raspberries is 5 grams of carbs. You know what I mean? Mm. So I can eat 4 pounds of raspberries and it's only 100 net grams of carbs. It's like ridiculous. Like, so there's a huge satiety per calorie. So basically I target protein first. Every meal centered around protein, the highest quality I can get and the leanest thing I can get. And then I add in carbs with a very low energy density. I might eat like a low carb tortilla, or I might eat a salad, or I might eat some low energy density, low sugar fruit. And then I'm also trying to get the lowest energy density fats I can, right? So instead of oil, which 100 grams of oil is 100 grams of fat, I'll eat an avocado because 100 grams of avocado is only 10 grams of fat. This is a low fat fat. So I'm eating low carb carbs and low fat fats and a lot of them. So I have tons of weight and volume to my food because, you know, most humans eat like 3 or 4 pounds of food a day. So you need foods that weigh a lot, have a lot of protein, fiber, and water and weight and volume, but not a lot of non-protein energy. So it's basically low carb and low fat at the same time. And that gives you the highest satiety per calorie. So I'm eating tons of weight and volume of food, but it's super low carb carbs like berries and salad and low fat fats like avocado and eggs and salmon. And then a bunch of lean proteins, like basically almost fat-free dairy and lean meat.
Right. Fantastic. So there you go. That's going to be the basis of what I'm going to be eating from now on in. And I'm going to see you. I'll be your ripped friend of the UK as well, Ted. So that'll be great. Just going to go into the comments now from the people who are watching. Now, like I said earlier on, if you don't know, you need to just put your name in, I believe, because Facebook won't let us see your name otherwise. So I can see Rachel Hill is here. I'll go to you first. Anyone else who wants to put a question is in, though, please do now. And also just to let you know as well, if you put a question before my Facebook group, I can't see that now. So put it here and then I can be able to see it. Okay. So the first one we have here is by Rachel Hill. Please can I ask what I should be consuming carb-wise, macro-wise to maintain my weight at 8.5 stone? I don't know what that is in pounds, which I guess is probably what you work on. She's 5'2". Well, we know you work in those measurements in America. Moderately active times 5 times a week for about 30 to 45 minutes. I am a 5'51.9 in Jan. I don't know what that means. Female. Oh, sorry. you'll be 51 in January. I get you now. Female. No diet restrictions and love wine too. Thanks a million. So just taking those details, what do you think would be a good macro carb ratio for that person?
If that's right. Well, basically, you want to gauge protein off of your height. So, that's 100 grams. You want to base protein off of your ideal weight for your height, I will say. So you give yourself 100 pounds for the first 5 feet as a female, and then 5 pounds for every inch over that. So you're 5'2", that's 100 pounds plus 10 pounds. So your ideal body weight at 5'2 as a female is 110 pounds. So you'd want to at least eat 1 gram per pound of ideal body weight based on your height, out of protein. So you want to at least eat 110 grams of protein a day, maybe even a little higher, 1.2 grams per pound, if you're just really cutting, if your goal is recomp, higher lean mass, lower fat mass. If you're trying to get the most muscle and the least fat, you want to at least have 1 gram per pound of protein, maybe at 1.2 grams per pound of protein. So for you, I would say you're going to want to eat about 110, 120 grams of protein a day. In terms of carbs, so this is where it gets controversial, right? I don't recommend zero carb diets. I don't recommend pure keto carb diets. I recommend like a low-ish carb, right? So the problem with shaving your, let's say you shave your carbs to zero, where are you going to get glucose from? Your body has to make like, you know, 70, maybe 100 grams of glucose a day. If you're doing any high intensity exercise, you're burning pure glucose at maybe a gram per minute. So let's say you do, you need 150 grams of glucose every day just to be alive and to do an hour of high intensity exercise. If you eat absolutely no carbs at all, you have to make that glucose from protein via gluconeogenesis. And now your protein requirement just went way up, or you don't have enough protein anymore. So you don't want to eat 0 grams of carbs. Typically, the PE approach is eating maybe 100 grams of carbs a day, and possibly a little bit more, maybe an extra a gram a minute for a high-intensity exercise. If you're doing an hour of high-intensity exercise, maybe 160 grams of carbs a day. And what you're doing to not get fat by eating what sounds like a huge amount of carbs to your average low-carber is to dial down fat at the same time by choosing leaner proteins, right? So you're eating your 120 grams of protein. You pick leaner sources so that your fat intake's lower. And then you eat your 100 grams of carbs, maybe 130, 140 grams of carbs based on your 30 to 40 minutes of high intensity exercise. And basically, you're trying to get the highest satiety per calorie and prioritize protein the most. And you're going to do that not by eating zero carbs, but by liberalizing non-starchy carbs like green vegetables and low sugar fruit. And you eat pounds of this stuff. So you get huge satiety per calorie and you're not worried about the little bit of extra carb because you need that glucose anyway, just to be alive. And when you're eating it, you're not going to destroy your protein you're eating just to make glucose out of it, if you know what I'm saying. So for you, I would say you're going to want to eat 120 grams of protein. I would be eating about 120 grams of carbs a day, with as much fiber as possible, like you want low carb carbs. And then fat, you're actually going to want to be eating way less than 100 grams of fat a day. You're probably going to want to be eating, 60 grams of fat. That would be, a rough estimate for me.
Wow, fascinating. Because that's the other thing as well. I mean, you said about sugar, the amount of carbs in sugar is just whatever the weight of the sugar is. But I guess with you eating meat or whatever, you might be thinking you're getting high protein, but if it's really fatty, you're getting actually less, aren't you? So, it's quite hard to know exactly how much protein you are eating, really, isn't it? Because you might think about 110 grams of steak. Well, I wouldn't know how much of that is protein, actually.
Right. So your average cut of meat is 25 grams of actual protein per 100 grams of steak, right? So if I have 400 grams steak, right? Yeah, it's about a quarter. If I have 400 grams of steak, I'm maybe getting 100 grams of actual protein. That's just a rough rule of thumb. But if you get your super, super fatty ribeye, it's actually way lower on protein. But if you get your super, super lean, it's a little bit higher. And that's why you kind of want to aim for leaner protein, just to get this higher protein percentage.
Wow, fascinating. So Wagyu beef certainly would be way, way low on protein, wouldn't it?
I also want to say I have a calculator online at proteinpercent.com, and there is a macro calculator at the bottom of that that allows you to just roughly estimate these macros based on your height. So if anyone wants to go to proteinpercent.com and just look at that macro calculator, it'll kind of give you an estimate.
Fantastic. Right. Another question here. I'm afraid I don't know your name. So if you want to put your name at the bottom, I'm sure I can find who you are. Anyway, but I hope you're watching whoever you are. And it says, I'd like to ask about lipid profiles following high protein, low carb diet, mechanisms by which we can end up with high cholesterol.
Right. So basically, there's this lean mass hyper responder phenomenon where if your carbs are super low and your fat intake super high, your cholesterol might explode. You might get a really high total, really high LDL. Nobody knows just how dangerous this is because you're typically at the same time getting thinner and you're getting lower triglycerides and higher HDL and a better triglyceride to HDL ratio and a better cholesterol to HDL ratio and lower fasting insulin and lower fasting blood sugar and lower A1C and lower body fat, lower blood pressure. Everything's getting better except for your total and your LDL. And so it's hard to know just how bad LDL and total is by itself. And interestingly, if you draw a graph of the risk, the cardiometabolic and cardiovascular risks from all these things, diabetes, smoking, high blood pressure, high total cholesterol, high triglycerides, high HDL, high LDL, being over fat, being insulin. If you rank them all out, total and LDL cholesterol by itself is like the very, 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 very lowest one. So it's already the lowest risk of anything else. So if you're eating low carb and you're way less diabetic and everything else is better, even if your total LDL goes up and even if that's a little bit bad, that's still the lowest, statistically the lowest risk of all the risk factors. So it's probably not terrible, but just how good or bad that is, nobody really knows because it's sort of an evidence-free zone at the moment.
Wow, fascinating. So we're at the cutting edge of discovering all this stuff. I'm going to try and get through these questions as quick as I can because there's so many. I want everyone to have a chance here. Here's a good friend of mine, Graham Phillips. I'll introduce you to him at some point. He's a great guy. And he says he would like to ask you about the evidence of cancer risk with high protein mTOR activation. What do you know about that?
Right. So too much mTOR activation is bad. But what people do, protein stimulates mTOR for sure. But what really stimulates mTOR is insulin and just being over fat. So anyone who's over fat, their insulin's high 24/7, 365, and their mTOR stimulation is way high, like every minute of every day, all the time. So if I eat twice as much protein and I get a little more mTOR spike after my meals, but then I just walk around way thinner every minute of every day and my fasting insulin is super low, the area under the mTOR curve is so much lower than someone who's over fat, but like restricting protein because it sounds like it triggers mTOR. I'm going to be infinitely better off, even though I'm eating twice as much protein and even though protein stimulates mTOR. So it's like completely ridiculous. This is what happens when you just focus on mechanisms and don't look at the big picture. Yes, protein stimulates mTOR. Too much mTOR stimulation is bad, but protein percentage makes you thinner and more insulin sensitive. And then your 24-hour a day insulin area under the curve is way lower and your mTOR stimulation is lower and your cancer risk goes way down as you get thinner. So basically it's like not quite the right way to think about it, in my opinion. And you have to trigger mTOR. If you don't trigger mTOR regularly, you're dead. You're dead. So you want to do that. You just don't want to overstimulate it. And being over fat is way worse than eating more protein.
So a sweet spot again, isn't it? U-shaped sweet spot. Where's the right place to be? Not too low, not too high. What creates higher levels? What creates lower levels? Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Good to know. Thank you for that, Graham. And thanks for your tweets as well. Sarah Buckley, who I know well as well, said many people think that too much protein overloads the kidneys. What are your thoughts on that? And when it's overload, I don't know what the actual impact of that is, because I think we urinate most protein away, don't we? So what's the effect that has on the kidneys?
Right. So you do actually have to filter out some of the metabolites of protein in your kidneys. And eating a lot of protein actually does work your kidneys a little bit harder. Your kidneys will maybe even physically get a little bit larger on a high protein diet, but kidney function tends to get better. See, we have meta-analyses now that show that kidney function and glomerular filtration rate improves on high protein diets. So it's completely mythical that too much protein harms your kidneys. It's basically impossible. You can't eat enough protein to harm your kidneys. It is creating work in your kidneys and they get larger and stronger and better, much in the same way that like running overloads your leg muscles. In a good way, it makes them like way stronger, way better. You're just basically better in general. So protein for your kidneys would be like a form of exercise that makes them bigger and stronger and better. Much in the same way that lifting weights would be overloading your muscles. Sure is, because you want to do that, because you want them to be bigger and stronger And so, yeah, absolutely. But like nobody's getting kidney problems from too much protein. That's completely mythical.
Right. Okay, then. Right. On to exercise now. And I'm trying to get through these fast as I can because I appreciate your time is precious and you haven't started work yet. You're probably thinking, come on, Dan, I've got a job to do after this. Give me a break. But I've got another one here. It says Facebook user, but I think this might be Tim in the group, but I'm not entirely sure. It says you put a lot of emphasis on high intensity workouts rather than low intensity sessions over a longer time. And by the way, I've started doing the resistance band training. I've got a resistance band here. Life-changing. I've got a stand-up desk, which I'd normally stand at. It's only when I'm doing the podcast I sit down, otherwise these things would be far too low. And basically, I use it during the day, and it's just, I've absolutely loved using it. It's just really changed. Anyway, I love resistance training. But anyway, so he's talking here about intensity versus low intensity. It says, I'm a master's runner, training for distance from 5K to ultra. What's your take on the endurance intensity balance for people like me? Will HIIT assist mitochondrial and capillary development as much as aerobic endurance running?
So like in my book, I focus on high intensity exercise just in a way, just to solve the equation for the smallest amount of time. So I'm right. trying to make the exercise
efficiency.
It's the shortest time as possible. And it turns out you can trade intensity for duration and just work out a couple of minutes a day if the intensity is super high. But the reality is all of these are on a U-shaped curve and you want all sorts of intensities of exercise. You absolutely want lots of walking. You want to hit 10,000 steps a day of just general movement. That's awesome. But on the other hand, you want just a little bit of sprinting at a super high intensity as well, because that's going to improve your VO2 max more than just walking. So you kind of want the full spectrum of intensities. You want a moderate amount of all of them. You want some zone 2, medium intensity. You want some low intensity, just walking. You want some bursts of super high intensity, and you want a little bit of all of this. I mean, there are these different types of exercise. There's resistance, there's cardio, there's high intensity cardio, medium intensity cardio, low intensity cardio. You want all of them. You want every single one of these to a moderate amount. And it's not like doing 100% of one and 0% of the other. Every one of those levers should be pulled moderately. You should be, you know, step count, doing some sprints, doing some zone 2, medium intensity, doing some resistance, and trying to find the sweet spot for all of them. There's definitely such a thing as too much or too little of all of them. We know what too little is like because the average American gets 0 minutes of high intensity exercise per day. That's a scientific fact. And that is not good. I think we've all seen what happens there. But on the other end of the spectrum, too much endurance cardio literally raises your risk for basically cardiac arrhythmias, right? We do see a higher incidence of atrial fibrillation and stuff like that. And people who are just doing hours and hours and hours of endurance cardio. So there tends to be kind of a sweet spot for everybody. And, you know, I don't have anything against ultras, but you have to recognize the fact that that's probably beyond the center of the sweet spot for most people for, you know, medium intensity cardio. So like how to find the balance there, I don't know. But I would just say, I'm glad you're exercising. That's freaking awesome. Keep doing it. And whatever you enjoy, do that because you're going to sustain it, right? Do whatever you enjoy and don't sweat the details that much. So just do exercise, do whatever you enjoy. And if you get a chance, try to at least check every box, you know, as often as you can.
Yeah, love that. I suppose, you know, evolutionary wise, we'd have done a bit of all of those different exercises because that's survival, isn't it? Yeah. There's something chasing after us, a saber-toothed tiger, let's run quick and get the hell out of the way. Or we're tracking down animals, so we have to cover long, large distances, but slower. And, you know, I suppose that's just part of the human experience to survive, isn't it?
Absolutely. And actually a very interesting comment on what you just said from an evolutionary perspective. The thing that prevents all animals from getting too thin is leptin. So like humans have leptin. And if your fat cells get deflated enough, your leptin gets very, very low. And that's just a trigger to just eat your face off. So no one's dying of starvation because of low leptin. That is the downward bound to getting too thin. Do you know what the upper bound of getting too fat is? Ooh, it's not leptin. Super high leptin, your body doesn't care. Super high insulin, your body doesn't care. The lower bound for getting too thin is leptin, preserved in all animals. Works really well. You will not starve to death. Upper bound, that's predation. That's getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. And it doesn't happen in society anymore. And that's literally why we just get fatter and fatter and fatter with no halt in sight, because we don't have predation. Now, am I saying we should just like let loose a bunch of saber-toothed tigers in the general populace?
Here's my tiger. Let's bring it in.
I'm not saying that, but that would actually
You heard
work.
It here first. You're saying that, and that's all we got time for. No, I'm joking.
Right. Yeah, but that's the reality, is that predation puts the upper bound on obesity, and we do not have that anymore. And I mean, which is good, but you know, that's the way it is.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, I want to go for like maybe two more questions maximum, because I don't want to take the mickey completely here with your time. I'm going to go to Chris Rooney, because I think this is an interesting one. Using the Lego logic, an egg contains all the protein to make a chicken. Is it better or worse for us than cow protein?
Oh, yeah, basically any animal is fine. We really only see these significant differences between plants versus animals, right? It's not like you have to eat an animal that's super cool. You don't have to eat a mammal or a human, you know, to get the right spectrum of amino acids. You really only see these significant differences in plant versus animal, not in between different animals. So pretty much any animal is going to be great.
Yeah, fantastic. That's great. There's some lovely comments here I just want to show you, because I think it's very nice that you see your success in the world and realize the ripples you create around the world. So the PE diet works for like a charm for me. Thanks, Dr. Naaman.
Thank you.
Fantastic. I'm really pleased to hear that. You know what? I can't imagine a career better than yours in a way that you actually make a difference to people's lives. That's really special. And you won't even know who they are or ever meet them necessarily, but hopefully you get a sense of the people you are helping, which is fantastic. Here's one from Dawn. Hi, I've done a low carb diet since August and lost 2 stone down, age 53. Fantastic. And, you know, people are mentioning here they love cheese. I love cheese. I think that's a bit of an issue for me sometimes. So maybe I should probably be a bit more careful about that with the fat content. Let's just see if we can find one more question that I think might be useful. Then I've got a comment from Twitter as well. Here we go. Right. Microbiome. I don't know who this person is. I assume you disagree. Well, we don't know what you think as yet with having a diverse diet for the gut microbiome. What are your thoughts on the microbiome and about the diet that relates to that?
I don't really worry about the microbiome too much, because I think it's the cart and not the horse, if you know what I mean. I don't think you want to drive your health through your microbiome. I think it's mostly responding to, you know, how healthy you are and what you're eating. But I do like diverse diet. I think your diet should be as diverse as possible, just in order, just from a micronutrient perspective, right? I think that humans just naturally try to eat some diversity to make sure we're getting enough of everything. And I like that. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, excellent, excellent stuff there. So thank you to all those people who commented. It's really lovely to have your comments put through. And I don't know if you know Steak and Iron on Twitter. He's hilarious. He's a really funny guy. Mm-hmm. And I know he's a big fan of yours. And he said this tongue in cheek. I just want to point this out now, okay? He said, if you're so successful, why can't you afford a shirt? Now, if there's ever envy described in a tweet, then that's it there. So you heard it here first. Dan, you are just envious of his body. So anyway, I just want to say a massive, massive thank you to you, Dr. Naaman. Thank you for coming on UK Low Carb. And thank you for the work you do. It's been mind-blowing. And the thing that I find really fascinating in science and in discovery and in this space of low carb and keto is that there isn't just an answer, but rather we're discovering all the time, and there are different ideas to be debated. And as time goes on, we're learning more and more. And it seems to be that every expert in this field has seen how they're wrong in the past and how they're still learning. And I find that incredible. So I'm just so grateful that we've got people like yourself who are part of that movement, who are educating us and who are pushing the boundaries and exploring this stuff. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Keep up the good work. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Anyway, take care, everyone who's been watching. Have a great evening. And Dr. Naaman, have a great day. Bye.
Thanks. Same to you.
Hello, you still there? Dan here. I can see you're one of the keen ones because you're still listening. So, got a very simple request. Please go and rate and review this podcast now on Apple if you haven't done so already. And I'll read it out next week on the show. So go and do that. Hear about your review next week. Everyone's a winner. Right, I'm going to shoot off now. Take care. Have a lovely week. See you next Friday.